I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
It wasn't until I realized that all other entrepreneurs are also making it up as they go along. Did I realize that, well, I can do that.
This is the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, supported by Baileys. Join us in celebrating women's writing from around the world in the 30th anniversary year of the Women's Prize for Fiction, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives. I'm Vic Hope, and I am your host for Season 8 of Bookshelfy, the podcast that asks inspiring and brilliant women to share the five books by women that have shaped them and their lives. Join me and my incredible guests as we talk about the books you should be adding to your reading list. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Shani Danda. Shani is a broadcaster, disability inclusion and accessibility specialist, and social entrepreneur. She's one of the UK's most influential disabled people and was named number one on the Sure Trust's Disability Power 100 list in 2023. Shani has been recognised with multiple honours and awards for her inclusion and activism work, including being named as one of the most influential women in leadership and a world-leading changemaker. She's one of the consumer experts on BBC's Rip Off Britain and a regular contributor on ITV's This Morning. Shani's intersectional activism and entrepreneurship has challenged social inequality around the world, and she's the founder of Diversability, the Asian Woman Festival, and the Asian Disability Network. Shani, what a bio! I feel so like honoured to have you here. Welcome. It's just a pleasure to get to chat to you, to get to discuss books, to get to discuss your life.
Thank you. But can you imagine how difficult it is for me when anyone asks me what I do?
Yeah.
I never know what to say.
What do you say?
I kind of tailor it to who I'm talking to, or what I think what might be most appropriate to them. But I kind of give it to them in a nutshell that, you know, I work a lot around inclusion, accessibility. You know, I always say that those are the jobs that pay my bills. Mm-hmm. And then there's so many other things that I do that don't. So that's how I describe it.
The ultimate multi-hyphenate.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about books on this podcast, but we talk about so much more. We talk about life. Looking back, were you always a big reader? As a child, what did books mean to you?
Yeah. Books have been a really important part of my life from a really young age. So I was born with quite a rare genetic health condition. So I spent a lot of time in hospital. I spent a lot of time not being able to move my body independently. And books were my escapism. And I also went to a special needs primary school. And I remember the teachers telling me there that I'd read all the books in the school. And I was like, what? So that was like interesting, and they're like, yeah, we've got to order the new books in for you to read. So I was, you know, a really avid reader, whether it was, you know, at school, at home. And then I used to spend lots of time in hospital, and I always used to get books gifted to me, but I loved it, and it was my escapism from such a young age. And to be honest, there's still an element of that now as an adult. Like, I love just escaping in a book.
We all need and deserve that escape. As a child, were you aware that you were escaping? Or did you just feel like, you know, I love this story? Did you know that you sort of wanted to get out of the world you were in, or the hospital bed, say, you were lying in at the time?
Yeah, and I didn't realise it at the time. I just, you know, was enjoying the stories or the book that I was reading, I guess. I guess as a child, I didn't have that much depth then. But yeah, I think it's more now as an adult when I reflect back on that time. And, you know, because so many people ask me so many questions about that time, it does lead you to reflect on it in a different way from when you were in it and experiencing it. So yeah, I think it's something I realise more now as an adult.
And now as an adult, I feel like we have to carve out the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
To be able to get lost in a book, to be able to escape. How do you carve that time out? When do you do the majority of your reading?
So if it wasn't for audiobooks, I just don't think I'd have the time to sit and read, which is really sad, especially because it's been something I've enjoyed throughout my life. But your life gets busy doing everything that I'm doing. So it's usually when I'm driving, I'm always up and down the motorway, or when I'm at home. So for me, the game changer has been audiobooks, mm-hmm. because there was a period in my life where I'd gone a long time without accessing any books because I hadn't yet jumped on the bandwagon of audiobooks, and I was just too busy in my life just to sit and read. So yeah, I was really, really glad when I got my subscription to Audible.
Looking back from that time when you cleared your school out and read every single book that they had to the point where they had to order new ones, to now, how have your tastes changed or developed, or have they? Like, do you still gravitate to the same types of novels?
Yeah, they have actually really changed. And of course, we've got podcasts now as well. But I guess when I was younger, I used to just read like teenage fiction or age appropriate books. Then Harry Potter burst on the scene. That overtook a lot of my time. And then now as an adult, it is more about escapism. So I love, you know, fiction, literature. I like comedy, but I'm getting into like thriller and like serial true crime stuff now.
That's a revelation, isn't
yeah.
it? I'm the same. I think I wrote off the genre, right? I was like, this is not for me.
Same.
And then once you're in.
Yeah, it was an Adele Parks book that did it for me.
I love Adele Parks.
You know, at first it was, you know, at first you get into it, you're like, oh, is this for me? And then I couldn't stop listening to it.
I feel like there can sometimes be stigma attached to books, you know, that maybe you see as a holiday read.
Yes.
Because it's a page turner.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with a page turner.
No.
Let's turn those pages.
Yeah.
Talking of the constraints, I guess, of the society around us and the need to then escape that into the worlds of the books where anything is possible.
Yeah.
You were born with a rare genetic condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, or brittle bone disease. But I know you said in the past that it's the barriers and the biases posed by society that disable you,
yeah.
not your diagnosis.
Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah. So my health condition's characterised by bones that break without any trauma. So I don't have to have an accident. I don't have to fall over. I don't have to have any type of injury for my bones to break. Just imagine that when you cough, your rib breaks. It's like you're made out of glass, essentially. And by the age of 14, I'd broken my leg 6 times. And whilst that might sound like a high number of breaks, on average, people with my condition actually break between 300 to 400 bones in their lifespan. So I've only had 6 breaks, so I do feel very, you know, fortunate that it's only been 6. And then I had lots of surgery. I have a lot of metal in my body now, but I don't beep at the airport. and lots of treatment to help increase my bone density, which has all helped and really, really worked. So in terms of managing my health, I have the best quality of life that I can with what's available, but it still doesn't remove all the barriers that I face, because look, I live in London. I can't use the tube. It really annoys me. I'm late to everything. Yeah. And also there's nowhere to park in London, and I don't just mean an accessible bay, because finding an empty accessible bay is like winning a lottery. I just mean anywhere. So what that means is, because stations aren't designed step free and only a very small minority are, I have to pay thousands every year in taxes just to get anywhere. So, you know, if it, if I go to the tube station and ring my doctor, what's my doctor going to do? They've done their bit. It's the responsibility of the people who design our infrastructure, who make decisions on where money gets spent for public. If we just use the example of audiobooks, they were created for the blind community. Mm. But because accessibility benefits everybody, there are so many more people that access audiobooks who can read books as well. So that's what I'm on a bit of a mission of, really, is helping people to understand that accessibility benefits all of us. It already does, and a lot of us don't realise it, because there are so many things that we all own and use that were initially created for a disabled person or the community of disabled people.
You've been doing so much work for so long to increase accessibility for all.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that in your lifetime, since you were a kid at that school that you cleared out the books, you've seen great leaps and bounds and changes, but I'm sure there's still so much further that we need to go.
Yeah.
Which I'd like to discuss in a bit. But to take it back to when you were reading, when you were younger, and the world maybe looked a little bit different, and you were escaping into your novels, let's talk about your first Bookshelfie book, which is The Secret Dream World of a Shopaholic by Sophie Kinsella. Rebecca Bloomwood has a great flat, a fabulous wardrobe full of the season's must-haves, and a job telling other people how to manage their money. She spends her leisure time shopping. Retail therapy is the answer to all her problems. She knows she should stop, but she can't. The letters from the bank are getting harder to ignore. Can Becky ever escape from this dream world, find true love, and regain the use of her credit card? Now, you've said that reading's been an escape for you ever since you were young. What was it about this book in particular that stayed with you? How did it help you? Why did you love it?
So I was gifted this book by my cousin when I was in hospital, and it felt like a very grown-up book for me to read at that time. So I loved that about it. But it was just so fun. And, as you get into the story, you learn about how chaotic Becky's life is. And I just, aspired to have a life like that where, because I really like fashion, I really like clothes, even though it's very difficult for me because I have a short stature. But I still really, love clothes and fashion. I found a lot of, I think myself in that book in certain ways. And I guess it allowed me to think about what my adult life would look like. Because as a child, when you live with a health condition and you just don't know what your body's going to do, I didn't always have that opportunity to think about, what am I going to do when I'm older? Because I always thought that I'd just keep being in that cycle of my bones breaking and just recovering from that. So it gave me a lot of hope, I think, when I look back on it now and I think about the age I was, where I was in my life, I think it was the perfect book for me to have been given at that time.
I love that you said her life is chaos, right? It's messy, but I aspired to that.
Yeah.
You aspired to the chaos.
Yeah, because it sounded amazing. Yeah. It sounded fun. And, I think as well, because my childhood was so restricted in so many ways, I made a promise to myself that I wanted to make every day count. I didn't want to have any regrets in my life. So I knew I didn't want to live a boring life. And when I was reading this book, I thought, this is so fun. She does all these things. Look, she's giving advice on money, but she can't even manage her own. So there was something really inspiring in that for me. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to have it all figured out.
When you're young, so often we look to the perfect characters,
exactly,
to the princesses, to relate to or to want to be like. And the fact that you looked to messiness and you looked to imperfection is something I've not actually really heard that much.
Yeah.
But it makes perfect sense if you felt like your life was it was restricted and it was so ordered.
Yeah.
Do you find Becky to be a relatable character to you? Maybe not the life that she was living, but the person that she was.
Yeah, especially in terms of her career. When I think about the things that I do now, I didn't even know what I do was an actual job. I never had this big life plan that I'd going to work in events and then, you know, work as my own boss, as an accessibility specialist. And I think Becky did that in her career. Mm. You know, she wasn't your typical person who works in finance. So I guess I didn't realise it at the time, but it was also teaching me that too.
Did you know what you wanted to be? Did you allow yourself to have a think about what you might want to be?
No, like, you know, when you were a kid, you're like, oh, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do this. But it was always like, well, it will have to depend on my health. So 16 was quite a pivotal age for me. I'd had all my surgery, I'd had all my treatment, and I finally stopped breaking. So I had time. I was like, wow, what am I going to do with all this time? And I wasn't prepared because I didn't know that that was going to happen. So I went to college and I studied a course in early years to work with children. I loved kids. I had loads of cousins, nieces and nephews, and they seemed to like me too. And I think it's because we're a similar height, but like, I could give them sweets and toys. So
yeah,
I thought,
power.
Yeah, the power, the authority. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to choose something I enjoy. So I actually started out my career as a nursery nurse, got quite complacent and bored with that, didn't see any progression for me in that. Also, at the same time, was struggling to get a part-time job. I had, on my covering letter, because that's what we used to have to do back then, you know, I used to have one sentence saying, I've got a health condition, but it doesn't affect my ability to do this job. And I applied for over 100 jobs and I didn't hit anything back. And I didn't understand why. I think I was quite naive in terms of understanding how much stigma there can be in terms of hiring a disabled person. But anyway, I took that one sentence off my covering letter and got offered an interview straight away.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, but it just taught me a harsh life lesson that people are going to judge my ability based on my appearance. But, you know, I have to work really hard. I feel like I have to overcompensate to get ahead in life.
Becky obviously loves fashion. You love fashion. I know you do. But fashion hasn't always loved you. I think it's fair to say. I saw that you modelled in London Fashion Week for adaptive clothing brand Unhidden. You've worked with Primark on their newly launched adaptive clothing range. Can you tell us a little bit about your advocacy work when it comes to fashion and clothes? Why is it so vital?
Yeah, I'm a big believer that there's no industry quite like fashion where they can change perceptions and new trends overnight like that. Mm. The amount of change and influence fashion has, I can't really see other industries having that same relevance or that same adaptability. And that's why for me, I think fashion is really important. You know, wearing clothing is a human need, but there are actually more clothes designed for dogs than disabled people.
Really?
That is our reality. You know, I'm the height of a 4-year-old. I'm nearly 40 years old, and there's nowhere I can go into a shop and buy and wear clothes. I have to get everything tailored. And it's not just the time and effort and energy. Like, I like to wear clothes as an extension of my personality. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm South Asian, I'm a Sikh Punjabi woman. Clothing in my culture is huge. It's, you know, it's such a celebration. It's so vibrant and signifies different things as well. But when you don't have access to that, or it's really hard to get that access, it makes you feel excluded. It just makes it all so much of a faff that you can't be bothered. And, you know, it's a massive extra cost for me to continue to like get everything tailored. And yeah, so it's always felt really out of reach. But, you know, one of the clients that I work with is Primark, and the work that I'm doing with them there, they're the UK's first high street brand to launch adaptive clothing. So clothing that's specifically designed for disabled people.
And it being high street is important too, because that's access in itself.
Absolutely. So not only, you know, do you have all the adaptive features, but it's accessible in terms of price, because we as disabled people face many unavoidable extra costs. And on average, it comes out to over £1,000 a month more that you have to find in order to retrofit all this inaccessibility. So it's massively important. But also, I never thought I'd see adaptive clothing on the high street in my lifetime. Yeah. So let alone see it, but help shape it. It's such an honour for me to have been involved in it.
And here we are, and the work continues, because like you said, access begets access.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to pave the way for itself.
Absolutely.
But it's got to start somewhere. onto another book now that you loved escaping into. You mentioned it at the very beginning there. Your second bookshelfy book is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling. Life isn't much fun at number 4 Privet Drive, at least not for Harry Potter, living under the stairs in a cupboard full of spiders. But all that is about to change. On the eve of Harry's 11th birthday, the letters start arriving. Harry learns that he has a place at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. An incredible adventure begins, and life for Harry Potter will never be the same again. Tell me about your memory of reading the first Harry Potter book.
Yeah, and I was always like, when I think back at that time, I was so glad I was the age that I was to appreciate it then. Like, when it was new and the first Harry Potter book came out, I remember like talking about it at school with my friends, and we would all like, oh, have you read it? And at first I didn't know what people were talking about. And then I got the book and I you know, you couldn't put it down. First of all, the size of the books. And it's
they
a
got
bit,
bigger and bigger, didn't they?
They did, but it's a bit like daunting. But wow, what a page turner. And I really feel like when I think back at that time and my childhood, that was such a pivotal thing that I remember, because it was something that me and my sister really bonded over as well. So she's 6 years older than me, but we were both as obsessed as each other, to the point where the books would come out at midnight, we would be there in the queue at the supermarket, mm-hmm. Waiting for the next edition. But I think, again, for me, it was that massive element of escapism, but it was just a richer, deeper experience. And I was so glad that I read the books before I watched the films. The films are obviously incredible, but when you read the books, it's your imagination that builds the story and the characters. So yeah, just Harry Potter took me through so many years.
We were the same, you know. So my brothers are all younger than me, but it really brought us together. It was a real bonding activity. We used to read them out loud. My dad used to read them and do all the voices. Oh, and it wasn't until we watched the film that we realised she wasn't called Hermione.
Yeah.
It was going Hermione Granger, and like Hagrid. But it didn't matter, because he would do all these voices. And, you know, like, there was a real sense of community, I think, regardless of age or background. That buzz that you described, and everyone being together in wanting to get their hands on the new book, it being the talk of the playground, got a lot of kids into reading who weren't necessarily into reading otherwise or before.
Yeah. And it also became a bit of a competition, like, what chapter are you on and what chapter are you on? Did you get any sleep last night? You know, the first night that you got the book. So, yeah, it was a big part of my life, especially as a younger person.
It's a story that becomes entangled in darker, more complex themes as Harry gets older. And in some ways, you could say that's why a lot of us stayed with it, because we all got older as well. We were hooked, and it mirrored our own experiences as we were growing up and beginning to enter the adult world.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And, you know, I've got younger nieces and nephews, and they didn't get into it in the same way that we did. And I really think it did capture a generation. And as you say, we've grown up with it and we've stayed with it as well. And there's been so many other things, like, you know, the theatre production and all these other things. And I'm still so invested in it all. But I think if something captures you at a certain age, it's the same with, like, the Spice Girls, you know. I'm still as obsessed with them as I was when I was a kid. But because I think they become such core memories.
Yeah, they got us right then.
They did. And, you know, that's priceless.
You've spoken at over 250 conferences and companies worldwide, including the United Nations, World Expos, TEDx. Talking of community and talking of having that platform where you've got people enraptured, what's it been like having that opportunity to share your experiences, to advocate for others and to use that platform?
It's been a dream come true, if I'm being honest. I didn't realise how powerful speaking could be, or just perhaps simply sharing your experience. And especially coming from a South Asian community, we're not really encouraged. Like, my family were quite conservative, like small c conservative, and, you know, women tend to be encouraged to be more submissive. And so there's me doing the complete opposite. So it was a big departure. Like, I had to really get used to that. It was a massive change. But when I was sort of in my mid to late 20s, I was becoming a more budding disability activist and campaigner. And I got into doing some campaigning with the disability charity called Scope. And it was the team there that really made me feel that my story was important, that it was a perspective that many people don't really get to hear. Because if we think about the representation of disabled people, it's not always as diverse that it can be. It needs to be better. And then also, I think it led me to realise that, yes, this is my story and I know it, but it can be so powerful for other people. I kept getting asked to come and speak at people's events or organisations. I had no idea at this point that it was a job or you could get paid for it. So I'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll come. I used to turn up, do what I did. And then it wasn't until a few years later, I was like, oh, people are getting paid really good money to do this and it's an actual job. But, it has a purpose. And then I took it more seriously. And so I didn't know one day I would be a keynote speaker or a host or a broadcaster. It all came about in quite an organic way, but I really love it because I also worked in events for 10 years and I hated public speaking.
Really?
Yeah.
And but you like
I
it,
love
now.
It now.
Yeah.
You can't shut me up now. But so as an event manager, I used to have to, welcome guests, do all the housekeeping, do all the thanks, introduce a speaker. I just wanted the wall to swallow me. I hated it. But I think the difference now is I'm talking about something that's so passionate. I feel like I really have aligned my purpose with my passion. And I get to see the impact that just my words make alone, let alone if people then work with me in other ways. So that's a privilege. It's an honour that people invite me to do that. It's a big responsibility as well, because it's talk about quite heavy topics, but I don't want to go into those spaces leave people feeling heavy with it. So it's a real art, actually. It's a real skill that you have to hone and understand that you're there to educate but also motivate people in a certain way.
It sounds like there was a transition where you learned your literal worth, because
yes,
you're literally able to charge for your words, for your story.
Yeah.
Did that have an impact on your self-worth?
Yes. And you know what it was? It was learning about something called the social model of disability, which is where we talked about how it's barriers of bias that disable people, mm-hmm. not your
not
health
you.
Condition.
Yeah.
Because what I didn't realise is, when I learned about it, it lifted this massive weight off my shoulders that I didn't even realise I was carrying. And the reason I think it was so important is because in my culture, disability faces an even further sense of stigma. So, from a young age, I'd have people saying to me, oh, you must have done something bad in your past life. That's why you were born with your health condition. And I was like, what?
Who's saying this to you?
There would be people in the community, family members. And I remember how that used to make me feel. I don't even know if I believe in reincarnation, right? And, I'd be six, seven, eight. And I'd be like, I wonder what I could have done. And I'd sit there and think, what could I have done? And I just think no child should have ever been made to feel that way. I'm a live and let live person. If that's what someone believes, great, but don't put that onto somebody else. So I had grown up with sort of disability as being seeing something as a source of shame, stigma, not only in my community, but also broader community. And then I learned about the social model, and it not only just, it was life changing, and I feel cringy when I say it, it changed my life, but it really did, because it gave me so much self-worth. It gave me so much validation. And when we don't have the power to change things like the tube, the next best thing you can give someone is validation, to be like, you know what, I might not be able to relate to that experience, but I can understand where you're coming from. That is massive. That's the next best thing. So let's keep validating one another. But lastly, it gave me hope.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this makes so much sense to me. If I can help others learn this, then won't we live in a much more accessible and fairer society? And then it's led me to all the things that I'm doing now.
Of all the things that you have done, is there a particular moment that stands out that young Shani would be so proud of?
Yeah, I'm often asked this question, and I think there's so many things I could say, right? I've done so many incredible things, but I always say graduating from uni, because I went to special needs primary school. Certain labels get put on you for that. A lot of people around me had really low expectations of me. I wasn't ever encouraged to think about higher education. And then I only ended up going to uni out of necessity, out of survival, you know, to the point where I didn't even care what the course was in. I just chose something I thought would be easy and didn't have many exams because I didn't think I was clever enough to go to uni. And it was hard. And I thought you had to be really clever until I got there and I realised you just have to hand your work in on time. It's not about being clever.
Just get it done, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think for me, graduating from uni, because I just know how hard it was. I know the journey it took me to get there, how much I didn't think that it was for me. Mm-hmm. And then, like, graduating. And now, you know, I was awarded an honorary doctorate, which, again, is just unreal. And I never thought these things would happen for me.
Yeah, it keeps coming back to not having felt you belonged in these spaces or not having the aspiration to achieve these things and then going above and beyond your wildest dreams.
And also not having representation.
Yeah, and if you can't see it, you can't be it.
Absolutely.
How are you supposed to know?
Yeah.
But now there'll be so many other young Shannies out there who see you.
Yeah.
And now they know they can.
Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Let's talk about your third book today. You've mentioned the intersection between being British and Asian, South Asian, Sikh, and navigating that. And it all feels very appropriate for But What Will People Say? Navigating Mental Health, Identity, Love and Family Between Cultures by Sahej Kulkohli. Sahej grew up as a South Asian girl in a white American community, constantly trying to reconcile her two identities, always feeling like she wasn't enough of either. Her mental health suffered, but her worries were met with shame. Eventually, Sahej decided to train as a therapist herself. In this book, she compiles her comprehensive research to create a revolutionary guide to democratize and decolonize the way we think about our mental health. Tell me why you chose this book. Why did it hit home for you?
This book has been everything for me in so many ways, and it was definitely the book that I needed as a young girl, and I'm so glad that Sedge wrote this and put this together now. But I came across Sedge from her Instagram page called Brown Girl Therapy, and I, you know, it's a big statement to make, but I think it's my favourite account on Insta. Again, it comes to back to that point of validation, because as a British South Asian, you know, with all my heritage from India, with still family members living in India, I always from a young age have felt this massive sense of conflict that I'm never British enough. You know, here I get asked to where are you from, I say Birmingham, and they say no, where you're really from. And then when I go to India, my family don't see me as Indian, so it's like, who am I, where do I fit in? And that's actually one of the big reasons and motivations why I created the Asian Woman Festival, because I was a young, you know, in my early 20s, and I was looking for events to go to as a South Asian woman, but the only ones that I could find were to book your wedding venue or buy a new sari. And I thought,
they're not the only things I want to do.
And I just thought, why is that anything that's offered to us as South Asian women? Why does it have to revolve around getting married or how nice you look in a sari? I wasn't interested in any of those things. And then I thought, well, it can't just be me that feels that. What if there's women that have already done that, aren't ready for that, or just want something different? Because, you know, there are still topics you can't sometimes talk about with your own family. There are still topics that still hold a lot of shame and stigma. Or there are just some topics that people don't want to talk about in certain communities. And I was looking for that safe space. And then because I was in events, I think that's the only reason this happened, I thought, well, why don't I create it? Mm. Coming back to the book, Sedge has given me the language and the knowledge that I needed to be able to understand these things and to navigate, you know, feelings, emotions, situations. Because for me and my generation, we're the first generation to be able to have the time, the resources, and again, I'm going to use the word privilege, to even do this. So for me, both sets of my grandparents came to the UK in the 1950s. My dad also came to the UK from India. My mum was born here, but they've all my past generations have all been only in survival mode. So there's a lot of feelings of selfishness about that as well. Like, they've done all what they've done, moved countries and, you know, laid the foundations for me to be able to do everything. But navigating that has been hard. Mm. But then it also comes with feelings of guilt as well. So yeah, I don't think I can really put into words what this book has meant for me, but it's not only just for South Asian people, it's anyone who is from a multicultural background. And I'm really happy that Asian Woman Festival hosted Sahaj's book tour here in the UK, and it was just a gorgeous evening, and it was brilliant. It was just a meeting of so many like-minded people who you could tell her resources have helped in so many ways.
Well, that's it, like-minded, isn't it? It's knowing that you're not alone, and there's something so special about the first book that makes you feel that way.
Yeah.
To know that other people have had these thoughts and feelings, and that it's okay, you can get through them. Yeah. Because they did too.
Yeah.
And you know, mental health is not, I think in a lot of diasporic communities and a lot of immigrant families, mental health is not something we talk about. I'm half Nigerian, and I totally get what you mean about the shame. I feel bad about saying that something's difficult when I know my mum grew up in a war, right? And she came here and it was really, really hard, and she's never complained.
Exactly.
But it's okay for us to say we feel a certain way and to need to work out what that might be.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
And because we haven't been taught that, and we haven't, that's not been explained to us, because perhaps we haven't had people in our lives to do that, which is not, you know, I'm not saying that in a negative way, but that comes with a big feeling, a big burden. And also, especially, like, you know, we're all living in the West, and then sometimes our identities are only relevant in relation to whiteness or what the dominant narrative is. And like, I've struggled with that too, but then I've not always had the language or the know-how on how to talk about that either. So If you haven't got this, you need to get it.
I'm gonna like you say, it's useful for everyone. Charity I want to shout out as well, Black Minds Matter, who specifically work with therapy and mental health resources in the Black community, because it's different. It is different.
It is.
And that needs to be acknowledged. How do you practice putting yourself first in day-to-day life? How do you prioritize your well-being and protect your energy? And I guess I'd like to know how you balance that with work that actually puts yourself and your feelings and your experiences at the heart of the fight.
Yeah. And you know, it's a lot sometimes. I never feel like there's an off button.
Yeah.
Because this is my experience, this is my lived experience, but then I also work in this space. And that's a choice I've made.
Yeah, but it's still a lot.
It is a lot, but that's why I have to be really intentional with self-care and with boundaries. So it's taken me a really long time. You know, I'm nearly 40 and I'm still figuring this all out. But I say no to a lot of things. And it isn't just because sometimes it isn't a right fit. It's just that I just don't have time at that moment, and it's prioritising what I'm looking to achieve and what aligns best. So, you know, I'm really fortunate that so many organisations want to work with me, but I'll only say yes to the ones that I know are doing it for the right reasons and aren't virtue signalling and aren't just doing it to tick a box. So having strong boundaries, whether that's at home or at work. And also, it comes back to the promise I made myself as a kid. I don't want to have any regrets, and I want to make every day count. And, oh, you know what? Another thing I've had to learn is I don't have to burn myself out to earn rest and to take time out for myself. And I think I'm getting better at that now, but I haven't had good role models in terms of that. All I've had around me is people constantly working and that being praised and seen as an accolade. So I've really had to unlearn that concept of you don't have to burn yourself out to have a rest.
Rest is actually very productive.
It is.
Learning that.
Oof, I get so creative in those times. You know, I actually have time to think. I'm not just in doing mode. So, yeah, it's having strong boundaries and saying no.
So much of your activism is centered on the importance of intersectionality.
Yeah.
That word comes up so much on this podcast. At this time, politically, seeing DEI schemes being rolled back by the Trump administration in the US, how are you holding on to hope? I said at the beginning, you know, we have to look forward as well as back. How are you navigating this moment when it feels sometimes as though we are going backwards?
Yeah, it is a scary time. And, you know, working in the inclusion industry, there's so many colleagues and friends that, you know, are facing the brunt of that as we speak. But I think there are a few things that give me hope. And the first thing I think we have to think about is inclusion isn't just one person or one department's responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility. So even if we are going to live through a period where budgets get cut, jobs are, you know, diminished and workplaces are encouraged not to prioritize it in a way that they have before, we can still, in all the things that we do every day, make sure that our actions and our behaviors and our language is still as inclusive as possible. And I'm a big believer in that, because how can just one department be responsible for the whole culture of an organization, let's say, or how can one organization be responsible for making a whole organisation inclusive and diverse? The buck stops with all of us. It's all of our responsibility. And my TEDx talk was titled D&I Isn't Just a Job Title. And I didn't know that at the time that it would be so apt now, but that's why it just takes me back to, like, it's not just a job title. It's something that all of us have to practice in whatever we do, because I believe every decision that we make, it can either raise or lower barriers to participation. Let's go back to the example of the tube. Someone designed it with steps. That's a barrier. So that, just that one simple decision that was made, perhaps that person didn't realise at the time, but that's what I mean when I say we have to think about the bias that we have, but also how we disrupt it. So, you know, what? It's tough at the moment. I don't think it's going to be like this forever. But what is also worrying is the weaponization of the language, of the terms woke. And when that's the dominant narrative, it's hard for anybody else's opinions to come through.
Yeah, it can feel so loud.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your fourth bookshelfy book now, which is Baby Does a Runner by Anita Rani, who we love on this show. We've had her as a guest before. Baby Soul has had it with just about everything. She's fed up with her job and her colleagues. Her love life is permanently casual. And underpinning everything is the grief of losing her much-loved dad. Then she finds some love letters between her grandfather and someone who is very clearly not her grandmother. Baby travels to India on a quest to find out more. And along the way, she discovers herself and the seeds of a romance she was not expecting. Tell us about this book. Why did you love it?
Oh, I love this book. And growing up, I never really read books from South Asian authors. So now there are more and more joining, the publishing world, which is just incredible, and it makes me feel so happy that I can give my younger nieces and nephews books from authors that represent them and stories, and you know, even down to people's names that we recognize that are our norm. So that in itself is huge. But I love Anita Rani. She's been someone, you know, on our screens in the South Asian community representing us for so long, and this book resonated in so many ways. So there's a joke in our community, the Punjabi community, that everyone will always have an auntie called Baby. It's a nickname that's given to you. And my mom's that person. Her nickname at home is Baby. So the main character's name's Baby. So that's a funny joke. But there was so much of myself that I related to in this character, because I went solo travelling around India, and in the book, Baby does something similar. And it was like rediscovering all the things I did, but through the character. There were so many similarities, because it was a big deal for me to go on my own, and I didn't ask anyone's permission, I just did it. And then the realisation didn't hit me till on the day, until I was hugging my mum on the drive saying bye to her as I was going to the airport, like what I was about to do. You know, India's not always the safest place for a single woman to travel on her own. And then with me having a short stature, and I made that rookie mistake of overpacking, so my suitcase was bigger than me. It didn't hit me until on the day, but it just felt like this incredible adventure. I'd taken a 3-month sabbatical from work, but wow, it was a fantastic adventure. But I got to relive it through this book, which is why I loved it so much.
You wrote a beautiful piece for Condé Nast Traveler actually about your own solo trip around India, how significant it was for you. As your dad and both sets of grandparents were born there, when was it and why was it so transformative and so important?
I think because I'd probably lived a very sheltered life. So suddenly, like, I was just off doing what I wanted to do. And especially solo travelling as well, all the decisions are down to you. You don't have to think about anybody else or what anybody else wants to do. It was so liberating, and sometimes the hardest decision of the day would be, what beach do I want to go to? I remember feeling like that in Goa. But it was an adventure. I didn't know how people were going to react to me. You know, I'm talking about how disability is viewed in my community here. It's totally different there. Often people would be shocked I'd be travelling on my own. They'd ask me where my husband was or where my dad was. I know that I taught people things when they met me, because they were just shocked at the pure audacity of me being there with my massive suitcase, you know, travelling alone. But I was also really touched by people's kindness, because I speak Punjabi, but that's not a language that everybody knows in India. You know, hundreds of language and dialects. So even when I didn't speak the same language, people would just come and help me. Like if it was getting on at a bus, you know, they could clearly see I couldn't carry my bag, so they'd just help me. And I was really touched by people's kindness, because all my trips to India prior to this, they'd always be to my family's village in North India, in Punjab. And I felt like I hadn't seen India. That was my only representation of it. But I knew there was obviously so much more to it. So I got to travel around 11 states. But it just taught me so much about myself. And, you know, the one thing that I love about travel is how insignificant it makes you feel. Because when you're in your life and in your head, and you're just so focused on things that sometimes aren't a big deal, but we can make them a big deal. When you're away from all of that, it just helps to reframe things. It puts things into perspective. And I really encourage anyone out there that is thinking about perhaps solo traveling or just taking a scary adventure, just do it.
Yeah.
Just do it.
I second that. Such a huge fan. When you say perspective, it's like reading, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it teaches you so much. It's the best education you can get, but also it teaches you empathy. Because you walk a day in the shoes of someone completely different to yourself. You see how others see the world. I'm interested in how disability was viewed while you were over there, you know. And also, you know, even here as part of the Asian community, how's that impacted the way that you view or experience disability? I know you started the Asian Disability Network, which is a fantastic platform that focuses on disability in Asian communities. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so what really kicked it off for me was I just met someone, who was 10 years younger than me, and we were talking. He was a South Asian, queer, Bangladeshi guy, you know, really, we had a great conversation. And what struck me is that even though he was 10 years younger than me, he had all the same experiences, negative experiences and barriers as me. And I thought, how has nothing changed?
Yeah, 10 years.
And then I stopped and I thought, well, who's doing anything in our community to make anything change? And there wasn't really much. And if there was anything, it wasn't from the perspective of the disabled person. It would be a parent's perspective, which is still very valid and needed, but still not the perspective of us. So, you know, off I went and created what is a grassroots community. And it was just about, again, creating a safe space, because, you know, figuring out how to navigate your ethnic identity, your religious identity, your nationality, any other identity, and then on top of it, a disability identity, is a lot. It is a lot. And I thought, I know I've needed help with this and I haven't had it. And then, you know, even talking to your family, they can't get it either, because they don't have your experience of a disabled person. They have it in relation to who they are to you, i.e. a sibling, a parent, a cousin. They still don't get what it means for you. So that's how that came about. And it's just been a place to connect with others, because what, you know, there's just some things you can't Google. There's some things you can only learn from each other.
And you're right. No one can ever know what it means or feels like to be you. But representation does help, and it does matter.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to this book. Anita Rani is a huge champion of this. And that's why we love her. Of course, there are so many different identities and facets of life that we need to see more of in what we watch, in what we read. The same is true of disability. Why is it so important for young people especially to be exposed to accurate and diverse representations in the media if we're to look forward?
Oh, yeah. And this is something I'm so passionate about, because growing up and not seeing yourself or any bit of your identity being represented, it does make you feel invisible. I remember the first time I saw disabled people on TV was for Children in Need. And while Children in Need is fantastic, they raise loads of money, it's a very rigid perception of disability, and there's nothing to counter it. Because if you think about, if we're just talking about disability, like, we only really see disabled people talking about disability issues on TV or complaining about the lack of accessibility. But we're way more than that.
Yeah.
We shouldn't just be pigeonholed into doing that. And as a broadcaster, I'm struggling with that, like with only being approached to talk about disability related things, which is why I love the work that I'm doing with Asian Network. It's nothing to do with disability. And I've often spoken about that, like, I always get shoved into the disability box, but it's probably the most mundane thing about me. There's so much more to me than that, but I never get a chance to talk about that so much, because it's always focused on one aspect. But every single person on the planet is intersectional, you know, and representation is so important, because if you can't see others like you or understand their journey or see yourself in those positions, then you don't have anything to aspire to. And, you know, I'm also an entrepreneur, and I never again thought that was something that I could do or be. And I never aspired to be one. I'm doing it because I know how to solve a problem that I've experienced myself, which is about extra costs. But it wasn't until I realised that all other entrepreneurs are also making it up as they go along, did I realise that, well, I can do that. So it's these small moments of realisation, but they can make the biggest differences in your life. Because I thought, oh, everyone who is an entrepreneur, they know what they're doing. There's this plan that they follow. There isn't.
And disability not being constricted to that sort of children in need trope, which is, as you say, narrow. It's so important. My favourite job, other than the Women's Prize, which is my favourite job to do, is the Paralympics. I host the Paralympics on Channel 4. And it's pure sport, right? Yeah, it's epic. Yeah. It's excellent. And that's it. And it's on the mainstream.
Yes.
And we're watching it as soon as the Olympics are finished.
Yeah.
With the same spirit. And I love that.
Yeah.
You talked about kindness when you talked about your trip to India. And that's a really important theme in your fifth and final book, Shelfie Book, which is Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. Eleanor Oliphant has learned how to survive. We keep saying that, survive, but it's not everything. Not how to live. She leads a simple life. Nothing's missing from her careful timetable, except sometimes everything. Then one simple act of kindness shatters the walls Eleanor's built around herself. Now she must learn how to navigate the world that everyone else seems to take for granted, while searching for the courage to face the dark corners she's avoided all her life. Now, this book was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2018. What makes it so compelling for you?
So this was a really different type of read for me, and I discovered it after it had been so highly praised and had incredible reviews. And when you first start reading it, it's such an unassuming story. You don't expect what's going to happen in the book and all the topics that it covers. But again, I think there was probably something that I saw in the character that I had experienced as well. But it's such a riveting story. It touches on themes of like grief, loneliness, mental health, and just about while things in your life could be okay, it doesn't mean that you're living to your fullest and true potential every day. And that was something that it really shows up for me a lot. And that's something that has directed the things that I do in my life. So I really resonated with that in this story. But it was just something so different for me to read at that time. So different from all of the other type of books that I would read. And it always stuck with me. And it's a book that I always recommend to others as well to read. Yeah.
You said in your notes you think everyone should give this a try.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because I think it just helps to reaffirm so many different things that we all probably think but perhaps don't realise it. And then to see it written in a book and you're like, oh, I'm not alone in thinking this or feeling this. I think you can be the most popular person and feel loneliness as well. That's a big theme of this book. And her mental health journey, I think that's really important. But it's not given to you in the traditional mental health ribbon. So there was a lot of surprises in the book. And, you know, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but it's got a lot of twists and turns, which keeps you on the edge of your seat.
And the way it's written, it is beautiful.
Yeah.
And you really are on her side.
Yes.
You are with her as we're tackling big issues, like you said, like loneliness, trauma, mental health. But it can open conversations in our day-to-day lives without kind of philosophizing, without being didactic. Do you think fiction can be a good way to tackle bigger or more difficult topics and add nuance?
Yeah, undoubtedly. And, you know, with this character, we learn that she's had a lot of trauma in her life, but it's teased out very gently. It's not like the be-all and end-all of who she is. It just emerges slowly throughout the story. And I think it comes back to, like, whatever your life has been or whatever your circumstances have been, they don't have to define you. Whether we learn that through fiction or whether we learn that from one another or, you know, each other's stories. And I think this book does that really nicely.
There seems to be a bit of a pattern as well with your picks today. Do you ever find yourself gravitating towards books that combine the trickier parts of life with humour and romance.
Yeah, because we need that light-hearted element. And, you know I definitely use humour as a tool when I'm delivering my keynotes. Like, I think I'm a funny person anyway. I know I make myself laugh anyway, but I think especially like humour is a really good tool. I'm never someone where I've wanted to take life seriously, but I've had to deal with a lot of serious and big heavy topics. So I know how much humour has helped me and still continues to help me. And whether it's about romance, you know, whether it's about how chaotic somebody's life is, there's always something relatable in this. And yeah, I love all these books.
You got to laugh though, don't you, sometimes?
Yeah.
You've just got to laugh.
Yeah.
And what was the lasting impression that this book gave you about kindness and the way we judge others?
So I think with this story, kindness is a big theme throughout. And again, it doesn't emerge straight away, but especially towards the end, and how, you know, her friends rally round and how she develops her confidence. And when I think about that in relation to me, it's the kindness of others that have helped me to believe in myself. It's people giving me the time of day when I didn't have the most confidence. And just how kindness, or just a simple act of kindness, can really transform someone's day. It doesn't have to be the biggest thing that you do or think about, but you might not even realise the impact that it can have on somebody else. And I know that in my approach to things, you know, I think I'm quite an empathetic person, and kindness is a big thing that I want to convey and help people feel. And I think this book is just a really nice reminder of that as well.
It seems like so much of your work is about creating those networks of support.
Yeah.
Because we all need each other.
Definitely.
We need people. And so what would you like to say to your support network who've been there?
Oh, just thank you so much. And the ways in which people have helped or just been there, or perhaps it was a conversation that someone had with me, you know, the impact is sort of immeasurable, really. And I think it comes back to this point that I'd love us all to understand or remind ourselves of a bit more, is there's so much more that connects us all than divides us. And I know so many people say that, but I genuinely believe that to be true. I know that to be true. You know, with the work that I do, I meet so many different types of people. It could be people that are at the start of this journey of inclusion or accessibility, or people that are more advanced on it. But I know that people don't wake up in the morning and think, today I'm going to make like life harder for this group of people. I know that. So I think it's just understanding the impact that we all have, that we all can have, and educating ourselves as all of our experiences continue to evolve. You know, what we expect from one another changes as well, whether that's a different use of language, whether that's better behaviour, whether that's being more aware of things. I just think let's all remember that this is our responsibility to just keep doing that learning, whatever that might be.
And the impact that you're having for so many people is just immeasurable, and continue to have. So from me to you as well, thank you.
Thank you.
My final question to you, Shani, is if you had to choose one book from your list as a favourite, which one would it be? And why? Your face says that you don't want to do that.
It's so hard. Just choosing these five, you know, is hard enough.
I'm sure there's been so many.
Yeah. I think I'd probably go with Serge's book. But what will people say? And it's such a classic line in many communities, you know. But what will people say if you do X, Y, and Z? I think it's a great tool for everybody, but if you are from a multicultural background or not, it will help people to understand, you know, other people that you live within society as well.
But what will people say? Well, what I would like to say is thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a beautiful chat. Thank you for being so honest and open and insightful. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, brought to you by Bailey's and produced by Birdline Media.
Thank you for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books discussed in our show notes. If you've enjoyed it, please leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. See you next time.